Anti-war sermons are, of course, easy because who is pro-war? Must be somebody, because they keep happening. We keep having prophets of peace. We have peace candidates. Everyone that you talk to believes in peace. And yet we keep having wars. And they keep being rationalized out of anger and out of fear. And they are terribly important. How can we believe in the efficacy of war? When you look to see what gets accomplished by all of the fear that turns to anger, that turns to violence, what gets accomplished by it? I know during the talk back we can talk about guns that get manufactured and bombs that get manufactured and cities that get rebuilt after they're destroyed. But really, what's accomplished in the wars that we fight, in all of the wars? We don't even know what a war is anymore. You're about to hear the one positive reference to Ron Paul. He's right. We haven't had a war since World War II. We just keep killing each other all around the world, but it's not a war. Of course it's a war. When we get angry and we get our blood running and we are afraid someone is going to do something bad, then we get wars in this world. Almost nobody, as Bob Dylan pointed out, thinks that God is not on their side, that all wars are just, all wars are holy. And of course, that's completely absurd and obscene. Wars are seldom just and never holy. Sometimes they may be tragic necessities, but very, very rarely, and not nearly as easily as people believe in the heat of the moment. We human beings have very quick triggers, and I mean that in every sense, emotional as well as physical. We perceive the danger, we become afraid, and we lash out with physical and emotional violence. The absurdity of it, of course, washes over me. As I was preparing and editing this sermon, it was Holocaust Memorial Day, where we think about 6 million Jews who were slaughtered for being Jews. 20 million Russians died in World War II. Untold number of innocents in every country that was involved in World War II. Untold numbers in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, untold numbers before our outbreak of World War II as Japan moved through Korea and China and into Southeast Asia. All to what end? The waste, the tragic waste, is just astonishing. When you look just at the European theater and the tens of millions of deaths that the irrational hatred gave not birth but death to. What is accomplished? If 6 million Jews had lived, if all of the gypsies and homosexuals who were exterminated had lived, if another 20 million Russians had lived, what could their contributions have been to the world, to civilization? But instead, lives, cities, futures were destroyed at that time, and still to this day, we miss the talents of the people. When we go to war, we almost never truly calculate the costs, the emotional costs to the people who kill, the costs to the people who die, the cost to the survivors, the cost to society, the cost to civilization. Everybody is changed by state violence. Everybody is changed and dehumanized, both in the killing and, of course, the being killed, as both killer and killed are turned into objects, objects of destruction and the destroyed themselves. And when you look at the absurdity of all this, all you have to do is look at what happens 10 years later, 20 years later, 40 years later, 100 years later. We watch films from ancient history 40, 50 years ago. We look at films that deal with some of the terrible internecine struggles in Europe, where people were killing each other over issues that we can't even begin to understand today. Was it really the difference between transubstantiation and consubstantiation that we raised armies for? Is it really about whether or not my God is more peaceful and loving than your God, that I'm going to slaughter you if we're on a different side? We don't even remember what we were fighting for, kind of like family sometimes. It's a great fight at the moment, but what was it about, and what did it accomplish? When I was living in North Africa, I suffered for my country being in the Peace Corps, and I had a 5-bedroom house on the Mediterranean, on the sand, and I hope you appreciate what I did for you. And I used to sit and watch the English and the German tourists parading up and down the beach. And you would see the German tourists marching because the German hotel was up on the north side, and you'd see the English strolling, hands behind back, like Prince Philip, who's also incidentally a Battenberg in German, but don't let that bother you. Shows you how stupid this stuff is. And I would look at them, and then sometimes they would meet at old battlefields and fall into each other's arms, where 30 years before they had been trying so desperately to kill each other. What was accomplished with the hate? What was accomplished with the fear? What do we get from these wars? The miscalculations, as well as the immorality that lead to these wars, is really astonishing. Really, truly astonishing. And I'm going to kind of give away where I'm going with this, and that is, today, one of the things that is very heavy on my soul is the chance of an accidental war with Iran. Miscalculation happens again and again when we fall into war. We believe that wars are going to be faster, neater, and cheaper than they ever are. The pundits, the experts before World War I, some said, well, the Germans and French would not kill each other because there was such a socialist sentiment that workers would not kill co-workers. Generals also said, it can't last more than 6 weeks, 6 months at the top. Experts looked at before World War II and said, well, we can do this. Rumsfeld looked before Iraq and said, well, we can do this. We can do this fast, and we can do this cheap. They're almost never, no, not almost. They are never right about the costs and the calculation in blood, in treasure, in the precedent that we send, and what happens in our own hearts when we get involved in these struggles. Smart people keep doing dumb things and making the same miscalculations again and again. Sometimes it's the law of unintended consequences. We think we're doing something peaceful, and it pushes a nation, and they decide to go off. We don't know the effects of our actions. We do know that when the shooting starts, we lose perspective, of course, and have to justify whatever is going on. We know from history that our calculations are going to be wrong. We also know that most human beings in the world do not want war. Americans don't go marching off to war as easily as we did generations ago or a century ago. One of the good things about worldwide communication is that we, in seeing the pictures and hearing the cries and feeling the destruction that goes on and the pain that is caused, we have, thank God, a lower tolerance for both dishing out and accepting violence. That's good. But at the same time that we have a lower tolerance, we have a multiplier effect in terms of the weapons that are out there in the world and the ability of an individual or a clan or a tribe or a nation to cause pain, death, and destruction. And we look around and I ask, when are we going to learn not to do these crazy miscalculations? Most people in the Middle East would live in peace with each other. Most Palestinians I know, and I know a lot of Palestinians, want to live in peace in a two-state solution. Most Israelis want to live in peace in a two-state solution. But the radicals on either side get the veto. The peace process can be stopped by a bomb and by a rocket. Most Americans want peace, have no, as Muhammad Ali said, I ain't got nothing against the Viet Cong. Most Americans were not born with some either rational or irrational hatred of the people of either Iraq or Afghanistan, but we have fought 10-year wars there and incidentally not achieved any of our important objectives. But it seemed important at the time, and the generals and the pundits said to our politicians, yes, sir, we can do this. In November, Ehud Barak, the Secretary of Defense in Israel, said, you know, if we have to strike at Iran and take out their nuclear facilities, the retaliation isn't going to be massive. It won't be hundreds of thousands or even tens of thousands or even 1,000 killed. That's almost certainly incorrect as the prognostications that generals and politicians, the generals tell politicians and politicians tell their people before these fast, easy, surgical wars happen. Sometimes you might have to have a war. Sometimes, rarely, you might have to have a war. There are times when there is evil in the world, but it does not occur with the frequency that we perceive it. Right now, in Iran, the law of unintended consequences is playing a very big role. The United States is afraid, with some reason, of a nuclear program in Iran. It doesn't seem like a great idea to me anytime a nation gets a nuclear weapon. As David Frum, the conservative, said, a nation can say they want to wipe Israel out or it can develop a nuclear weapon. If it does both, there's a bright line that gets crossed, and I kind of understand that. But we don't understand the difference between trash talking, which is non-diplomatic language but very common to the Middle East, and we don't know where the various lines are. We are right now in danger of blundering into a war that actually, I think, literally nobody wants. Not Israelis, not Americans, not Iranians. Can we avoid it? I pray so. I hope so. I have faith, but it's the faith that has to be put into action of people witnessing for peace and writing to our Congress people and making some noise for peace, some peaceful noise for peace. The danger happens right now, and this is the law of unintended consequences. We would like Iran to come to the table, and at the same time we are telling the Iranian government we would like a regime change. This is kind of a mixed message. It may be extraordinarily subtle, or it may be incoherent. I hope it's subtle, but I'm not at all sure. Rather than going to war, we say we're going to give sanctions a try. Well, sanctions work really well, ask the Cubans. We've only been doing that for 2,000 years. But to the extent that sanctions work, they can have unintended consequences, not just in terms of it's always the poor who suffer, but it also because to the extent that the United States and the United Nations are able to stop Iran from selling oil, they render the Straits of Hormuz with less value. As long as the Straits of Hormuz are open and the Iranians are selling oil, they want to keep it open and they can just threaten to close it, but it's very unlikely. They threaten to close the Straits and we send in a carrier task force, and England is going to send in a carrier task force, and the opportunity for accident is huge. It's immense. In my view, this is a Gulf of Tonkin waiting to happen again. It only takes one frightened officer or enlisted person firing a gun out of fear, one terrorist in an Avon or Zodiac with a bomb in it running into an American ship, and all of a sudden there's a shooting war. This is immensely complex stuff, and we are entering a very, very dangerous time. I don't think driven by warmongers. There are warmongers in the world and in every government, but I don't think they are driving the various ships of state. But there's a lot of trash talking. There's a lot of provocation. There's a lot of physical chess that is going on in the world, and a lot of people making easy and glib observations about, well, if it did start shooting, we could handle it. If we did need to take out their nuclear facilities, we could do it cleanly and without too much collateral damage. Conservatives often talk about the United States not being in the business of being the world's policeman, but often do policies where we are the world's policeman, bringing the blessings of democracy and our version of liberty to the rest of the suffering world. It is our gospel of democracy in which we believe. And I would ask you to compare it to the gospel that colonial nations believed in the 19th and 18th century, that they had the responsibility to bring the blessings of those four gospels to the primitive world. There's an amount of both arrogance and lack of understanding of what happens when we try to project our power and our will on others, when we believe that we can do what no one has ever done before and make peace through strength. World War I was the war to end all wars. As Dr. Phil says, how's that working for you? As we try to bring our values aggressively, there's a contradiction. We can't bring our values aggressively. We can live our values. We can be exemplars to the rest of the world and attract them by our goodness, not by necessarily by our bravado. The costs of war are obviously terrible. And as I hear the discussions going on in the media and with the talking heads and with politicians, the bellicosity, not simply in the Republican debate, but the bellicosity in the state of the nation, I wonder when fear turns to anger and anger turns to bloodshed and bloodshed turns to soldiers and soldiers turn to graveyards and graveyards go to flowers. When will we ever learn? When will we ever learn?